Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee will come to order. Senator Murphy, you're first up with Senate File 1142. Senator Murphy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1142 is, it's a two-sentence bill, and we just want to welcome home the Vietnam veterans, and we want to designate June 13th here in the state of Minnesota as to welcome home our veterans. And I think a lot of folks on the committee either have a poster in their office or they've seen the posters, but on the 13th there's going to be a celebration, and I really believe that Vietnam veterans were treated, I believe, differently on their when they came home than veterans from almost any other activity that we've had overseas. And as you can see by some of the co-authors on the bill, Senator Erickson Ropes is a distinguished veteran and served in the Vietnam theater. Senator Dill was in Vietnam, and he was working at that time as a veterinarian and doing a lot of work. And Senator Dill can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that when you were over there, they had a pseudo-rabies problem. Was it pseudo-rabies or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, the pseudo-rabies was not a known disease over there at that time, but there was foot and mouth disease and rinderpest and Newcastle disease and poultry and hog collar and hogs, pasteurilosis. There were a lot of diseases over there, but pseudo-rabies was not one that we commonly encountered.
But, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dill, we were just talking about this bill, and I was talking about a few of the co-authors and some that had been in the Vietnam War or in that theater. And while I just wanted to commend you for your service as well, there was hundreds if not thousands of people who served in that theater, much like Senator Dill, as a civilian. And all the service that they provided should be acknowledged as well. So we had a lot of people over there, working on the pacification program, working in animal health, like Dr. Dill. And in my opinion, I think that a lot of the folks, both military and non-military, performed admirably. And I do believe that some of the hard work that those folks put in, has paid off in long-term relationships with the country of Vietnam. So, but Mr. Chairman and members, I kind of went on here a little bit too long. I know that there's other people that would probably like to say a few words about the bill. Members, but like I said earlier, Vietnam veterans were, they were treated differently when they came home. And it's good to see now that some of our servicemen and women are coming back from theaters in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, and they're being accepted back into the communities with open arms. It's been a real change, and a change for the positive, and I think that a lot of military families are much better off today knowing what some of the Vietnam veterans went through on their return.
Senator Murphy, do you have anybody else that you would like to bring up? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
John Cox, legislative chairman for the American Legion, about 160,000 strong in the state of Minnesota with the Auxiliary and the Sons and the Legion. I agree 100% with Senator Murphy on the Vietnam veterans. I recall I worked in the Minneapolis Armory at the time of the Vietnam War because I was in during Korea, and we had to stop wearing our uniforms wherever we went. Out of the armory, they'd throw rocks at us, eggs at us, spit on us. And we couldn't wear our uniforms to work. We couldn't wear them home. And the only place we could wear our uniforms is if we went over across the corner to the cafe. And I think this is overdue. I think what we're going to run into is you're probably going to see the Korean War veterans are probably going to be looking for their day, too. But that's coming up. But I agree that it's time that we get all these people together, celebrate their day so that they have a chance to visit with everybody. And we need to let them know that we support them 100%. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other, anybody else, Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably it. But, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1142 be recommended to pass and placed on the Senate consent calendar.
Everybody understand the motion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ropes, you're next. Senator Ropes' bill is Senate File 691, Railroads Pesticide Application Regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you moving me up in the schedule. I have to get back to my district this evening. We're having a big community reading program at La Crescent, so I want to get back to one of the schools there and do a little reading project with them in the evening. So I appreciate you moving me up. We have an author's amendment that will need to be passed out. And while that's being passed out, Mr. Chair, I'll just remind you that I was before this committee in my rookie year, bringing forward a railroad pesticide bill, and I've kidded Senator Dill a little bit about this over the years. It's, he had an opportunity to really sort of chew me up one side and down the other on this bill because it wasn't ready for prime time when I brought it the first time. And he wound up getting the famous Dill giggles, I think, if you remember that. We had one provision in there that would have required like 168 days notice in advance of using bleach in the bathroom. So thank you, Senator Dill, for helping us correct some of that language on the use of pesticides. But I have today a really great bill in the form of the A3 amendment. I'd like to offer that as the author's amendment.
Senator Ropes, would you like to move the A3 amendment to get your bill in order before you jump to get over here? Senator Ropes moves the adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order, Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We started out with quite a long bill 3 years ago and have been working on and off with this bill with the railroaders who are union members, the railroad management and railroad representatives, as well as the Department of Agriculture. And we've taken out several key provisions here, and I'm just going to run down a couple of those things that we've taken out to let you know how far this bill has progressed. But we did have provisions in there for the commissioner to come up with a scheduling plan for applications of the pesticides, a requirement that they would not have to work for 48 hours afterwards in that area at all, a requirement to provide personal protective clothing, and on and on. In addition to washing down all of the equipment, including the cars that the railroaders might have some contact with. So we've come a long way in revising this bill, and you'll see before you just this short subdivision 9, which is basically a plan where the railroad company would be using commercial or non-commercial applicators to apply pesticides, you know, clean up the road side or the railway side. And the railroad workers really want to have an opportunity to get at least 48 hours notice before they're going to be asked to work in an area that's been sprayed. and they want to be aware of information that's on the applicators or the manufacturer's information, active ingredients and that sort of thing. And then the employees would also like permission to opt out of that work area and be reassigned to, let's see, what do we say here? Be offered commensurate reassignment away from that area if they feel like exposure to those chemicals are going to put their health at risk. So basically that's what this bill is. It's just a right-to-know notification for the railroad workers so they can get out of a treated area. And I have Mike DeRosa, who's here today, and he's going to do some testifying on the bill, and then we have a few railroad workers and systems, railroad systems testifiers as well. So, Mike DeRosa.
Is that okay?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike DeRosa. I am state legislative director of the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees, a rail union for track workers. I've worked on the railroad for 35 years. Every spring, railroads employ commercial applicators to spray herbicides on railroad tracks and right-of-ways. The chemicals kill the weeds and brush that could cause roadbed and safety issues. Every herbicide used on railroads has a MSDS sheet. The MSDS sheets list the potential effects that exposure to these herbicides can cause. Most of these herbicides can cause eye and skin irritation, sometimes severe, and can cause respiratory problems if inhaled. There has been several recent incidents on railroads involving herbicide application. Railroad workers have been sprayed and exposed to chemicals immediately after application. As recently as last May 15th, the BNSF trainman was sprayed while working in Wilmer. Railroads will say that employees are notified, but the information is not getting down to employees. Lower management is not letting workers know when and where the spraying is taking place. This would not be a difficult assignment. Train crews receive orders every shift before they go to work, and all other crafts have briefings before they go to work, identifying hazards and work duties. We believe that not spraying pesticide on locomotives and track equipment, giving employees the opportunity to work in other areas, and giving notice of weed spraying would eliminate these incidents. We've been working on this bill for 3 years. We have had several discussions with the railroads and the Ag Department. The next four testifiers will discuss incidents that have occurred on their railroads. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is William Jordy. I am an assistant chairman for the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees on the Union Pacific Railroad. I represent members of the Unified System Division, and I've been with the railroad for now going on 41 years. I've worked in this capacity for the last 18 years, and I represent approximately 3,700 members on the Union Pacific Railroad and other railroads in the unified system. Mr. Chairman, about 122 years ago, the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees was founded, and one of the founding principles was to provide our employees with a safe workplace. Now, later today, in this hearing, Mr. Apitz and his colleagues are going to be showing you some videos of how herbicide application is performed on the railroads. I saw a bit of a preview of it here earlier when Mr. Apitz was setting up. It's a great little movie, but it doesn't show you the actual hazards that are involved. I have prepared a copy of my testimony here today for each member of the committee, and attached to it are about 22 statements from employees that I represent giving their personal incidents with problems with weed spraying application, from being sprayed while they're working to questioning the application process. What is this that we're being subjected to? Their questions are good, legitimate questions. Mr. Chairman, it would be tantamount to you're coming into work in the morning and you finding dust across your desk. Someone says, well, we sprayed in here. It's a chemical. Here's a book. Here's our MSDS book. We've told you what that is. Well, they've told you it's in that book someplace, but you have to look for it. You have to know what the chemical is. The railroad isn't providing that information today to our employees. They're being injured, in some cases severely injured, and I've cited in my testimony one incident in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One of our B&B employees showed up for work in the morning, got out of the truck, walked towards their tool car that was covered with a white residue. The man dropped to his knees. He was having an allergic reaction to the herbicide that was applied. Required emergency medical attention. His skin, exposed skin, broke out into blisters. His breathing stopped, and the man required several blood transfusions to, you know, get himself back to health. But it was all because he didn't know that the area had been sprayed. We're asking that the railroads be required to give that minimum advance notice to our members, letting them know what they're going to be exposed to. Don't just tell them it's a weed spray. Give them the information. These are the possible effects of it. Let's give our people the information they need to work safely. Now, again, several of the statements are included with my submission here today, and I would not burden you with reading each and every one of them, but they are there. These are handwritten statements from the members themselves. So it's not a he said, she said type incident, you know, with the railroad saying, we do it. These are the actual members that have been affected telling you their stories, and I hope that you take the time to look at that and support this bill for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I have Gene Bell. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gene Bell. I'm an employee of Soo Line Railroad Company. I've been an employee since September 10th of 1979. Just to start off, I'd like to relate one incident here that happened on the Soo property. I wrote the statement up, but I'll just simply read that for you to give you a little bit of how the crew is when they're actually out there performing work. Said on July 18th of 2006, Soo Line Railroad hired an outside contractor to spray for weeds and vegetation along the right-of-way west of Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the vicinity of Loretto and Hamel. The contracted applicator came through this area and sprayed for weeds at around 10:30 in the p.m., what the employees referred to on the sessions as a spray train. The next morning, when the crew was traveling from Loretto to Hamel, traveling east with on-track equipment, we traveled through this area with the on-track equipment at a high rate of speed for some 5 or 6 miles. After the applicator applied the herbicide, pesticide, it rained. As the crew was traveling, the men and equipment traveled through the sprayed area. The crew consisted of 39 machines and some 40 men. As the crew traveled through this area, and since it had rained the previous evening after they sprayed, a mist was created that the men and equipment traveled through. Some of these employees stated they could smell an odor in the air as they traveled through. Later that day, some of the men complained of burning sensation in their throat and eyes, and some complained that whatever skin was exposed, they could feel a burning and itching sensation. A few developed rash-like symptoms. The crew was very upset and wanted to know why they had these symptoms. After many complaints from employees about these symptoms, the foreman called the supervisor, who had responsibility for this crew. The supervisor was called home previous to when the contracted applicator came through the work area and sprayed on account of a family emergency. The supervisor was informed of the weed spraying, but unfortunately, the supervisor had forgotten to inform the foreman of the crew. After the foreman was informed that the area had been sprayed, he had asked what kind of chemicals had been used. No one had information on that, nor was there any MSDS sheets available. The union, upon its investigation, found out that well over 90% of the time, employees who would be in contact with the applicated areas were not informed. Of the weed control application, and even if they were informed, some of the information was not correct. The contracted applicator had a tight schedule and would not deviate from it, even when informed not to spray in a certain area. The employees also had a hard time recognizing areas that were sprayed, as there was little to no indication of what areas were sprayed. The employees stated that they might see white slippery spots on the ties and the plates. I feel that legislation must be provided so that this practice cannot be continued. It's evident that railroads have practiced habitual behavior in not supplying information to its employees prior to application. Just ask your representatives to consider this letter when making your decision. I appreciate your time. So, thank you.
Questions? Move into the next one.
Thank you.
Dave Brown is here. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Vickerman and esteemed members of the committee. I am David Brown, and I'm chairman of the Minnesota State Legislative Board, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers for the state of Minnesota. We're a division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Rail Conference. This full-time position that I have is also complemented by my full-time position as a locomotive engineer on the BNSF Railway on the Engineers Extra Board. I'm employed here in Minneapolis, and I have been employed with the Burlington Northern for going on 38 years. On speaking on behalf of the BLET, we support this bill, S-691. We feel this legislation will not overly burden the railroads with increased regulation, but will provide their employees a greater awareness and, in kind, a safer work environment. I would like to address the issue of the weed spraying training and weed spraying notification that I have not received in all my years on the railroad. You may be told that of training of CDs or pamphlets and others he said or she said type issues. The fact is, through my personal experience and throughout my railroad career, is the people that profess the knowledge of training and notification do not work in the everyday field of railroading. This is not a matter of disrespect by any way or means, but a matter of real world, real life, everyday railroading. The training that I have the knowledge to have received is a very short CD on hazmat transportation issues that occur every second and third year of my career to retain my federal license. There have been, if not the job briefings or the same day notifications that I, as a full-time engineer, need to perform my duties safely. I have a saying that learn to be safe and live another day for life. Be prepared, not surprised. This is a model that I try to embrace each and every day at work, but I am frustrated in the timeliness and means of gathering the information to come home without bringing substances from my work home to my family and friends. I have access sometimes, sometimes not, with the type of systems that they have at work at my on-duty sites. These are working sites that have access to a company's web page that have on-demand material safety data sheets. The MSDSs that are available to print out from those if the printers are working. There is no means the way to bring up the sheets on the screen so you could read them on the screen. They have to be printed. The real key here is being aware of what, when, and where, to have the knowledge to be safe, and to simply know that I need an MDS sheet to be prepared for a weed-sprayed area. To the best of my knowledge, throughout my 38 career, I have never been instructed that weed spraying will be occurring in my work area, be it either on the road or to my recreation when I work the yard. We are professionals in our field of work, and we have duties that entail becoming acquainted with many rules, track, general orders, superintendent notices, and other issues that will affect our work areas each and every day. But we need the access to them, and we have repeatedly for many years requested that the information on the weed spraying advanced timelines and preventive measures to be taken be made available to us in real time. In some areas, this may not have occurred, but to the best of my knowledge, in my world, they have not. I would like to, at this time, take you through an incident that occurred to me with me in the spring of 2008. This incident happened to me and my young crew that I had with. We were called to work a local job that worked from here, Minneapolis, to Hinckley, Minnesota, and return. We performed work between industries between Coon Creek and Hinckley, Minnesota. While we were servicing an industry in Andover, Minnesota, We noticed a white film covering the track and the ballast and the track and the switch stands that we were working with, and a very strong chemical smell. The crew handled the switches and walked on the ballast. When they were done with the work, they came aboard the locomotive and started to eat. I asked them if they knew what the white stuff was and if they did, but and was it what the white stuff was, and they didn't know, but it was damp and stuck to their gloves and boots. The chemical smell was quite overpowering. I told them that maybe they should wash their hands before handling the food. They rinsed off the best they could, but on locomotives, we do not have facilities to properly wash. Not knowing what kind of chemical the company was using left us very much in the dark. The stress of not knowing what may or may not decrease your lifespan or worse, harm your family in any way is very distressing. We found out after we passed the weed sprayer on our siding that they were spraying just minutes ahead of our movement on the tracks. This occurred not only to my crew, but to all the crews that work that line, and that's UP Railroads, CP Railroads, and the BNSF. We come all the way from Superior to Northtown. They come from St. Paul to Superior, and they come from Minneapolis to Superior. None of these crews were notified that there would be spraying on the line that day. I hope that the written documents that have been placed in your packets are from employees that work every day and have made these statements to relay their real-life situations that have occurred on the jobs they work. They are these employees, we are the safest and most productive railroad employees in the world. And all we ask is to be able to do our job safely and have the tools to do that. And at this time, I'd try to answer any questions the committee may have.
Questions from the committee? Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just been listening to the stories here. It seems like it's quite a dangerous place to be working. Is there not any federal law regarding the Right to Know Act on this type of equipment or this type of spray? What has your union negotiated at all or talked with management over this?
This has been an ongoing issue as long as I can remember. Proper notification. It's a matter of maybe at the top, but it doesn't trickle down to the bottom.
Just last year.
Whether it's a federal requirement, I'm not aware of that, of any type of federal law that states that. I could be wrong.
Can I interrupt and follow up?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. So, line 1.3, 1.13, employees must not be required to work in an affected area. How long would the railroad be shut down, for instance, over a spraying incident, do you think? I mean, is that possible, or it actually stop the rail from going through?
Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe that the spraying could be done in a convenient manner. That would alleviate that circumstance. That I think with the proper notification that we work all kinds of round track work all the time, and this would be nothing more but another piece of track work. That I believe that with the time frame, yes, it would be a little longer windows, but it could be done.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you. The reason I'm inquiring, I was part of emergency management would deal with some of these types of substances, and I know there's some pretty stiff regulations on this and the Right to Know Act and whatnot. And does the railroad have a safety officer that would be in charge of doing this? Is there somebody that's in charge that's actually breaking down the system here, or is it?
Chairman Rickman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, the BNSF has a safety manager. But like I said previously, that it's very difficult sometimes, I believe, for things that are intended at other levels of a company to come down to the grassroots to where it's supposed to be placed. I don't have an excuse for the railroad for them not notifying and bringing down that information to where it should be. I don't know where the failure is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the railroads have been cooperative with us in working towards some kind of resolution here. In fact, they've given us copies of their policies that outline, you know, the sprayer contractor and the steps that they're supposed to take. And so, in fact, actually, Burlington Northern, as a result of our talking about this sort of thing, actually improved their 10-day notice. But these are internal policies, it seems, and sometimes the policies aren't always carried out. And I don't believe that there is anything on the state books at all regarding employee protection related to the pesticide exposure. So what I'm saying, Senator Ingebretson, is they may have a company policy, but we're hearing over and over that it's not being implemented.
Just one short follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I can. Is the railroad here to testify today?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
I have Phil Qualley.
Good afternoon, Chairman Vickerman, Senators. It's a privilege to be at your committee table, and thank you, Senator, for bringing this bill forward. My name is Philip Qualley. I'm State Legislative Director for the United Transportation Union, representing over 1,200 conductors, trainmen, switchmen, and foremen in the state of Minnesota. The UTU supports this legislation. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to follow up on Senator Ingebrigtsen's question. And that is by federal law, 49 Federal Code of Federal Regulations, CFR 49 and 213 covers track and vegetation. There is no federal regulation about in that code about notification on spray of vegetation to workers on or about the tracks. However, the railroads are required by federal law to provide the MSDS sheets to workers who are affected. With that, if I may, I will just speak very briefly. We have an affidavit before you. We think that the key components of this bill is notification. And we think that that simple request is reasonable. The other piece of this legislation is that with respect to the Department of Agriculture's concern about notification as becoming an industry trend, we certainly respect that concern. However, railroads are privately owned interstate corridors of commerce, and we are a very separate type of business. And so we believe setting up a notification requirement in statute is fully reasonable. I would also like to point out that we have before you an affidavit of a UTU member, conductor Stephen Olson from Wilmer, Minnesota. It is in your packet received this morning. And Mr. Olson was not only sprayed last year in Wilmer Yard, but he was also sprayed the year before in Wilmer Yard. He's okay. No injury claims or lost time injury. But the bottom line is, Senators, whatever's happening out there, whatever the carrier management is, wherever it's breaking down, we're not getting notification, and that's really all we ask. Our conductors and switchmen go out and work on or about this stuff. There will not be a great delay to commerce. We usually have a 20-minute to 30-minute window, and we're asked to get back out there, and by the chemicals application, that's supposed to be sufficient time. What we do run into is train crews are told by managers get back out there sooner. The production quotas, pressure, perhaps a harassment, intimidation situation develops in the yard office. We don't want to see that. When we have proper notification that the area will be sprayed in a short number of days, a 10-day window, we know what to expect. Finally, I would just like to say that in the spirit of compromise, UTU has compromised off a key piece of language. If you look at, I believe, paragraph E, it lists things, that pieces of equipment that should not be sprayed. And we have agreed to remove rolling stock, which would be all railroad cars, in other words, wheels and things like that. We want to see this legislation move forward. We've compromised off perhaps the most important piece of railroad equipment to our craft of employees. In closing, I would simply like to say that we, again, appreciate and respect you hearing this bill. We think that this legislation brings forward a workable solution and will resolve what has been a year-after-year problem in the railroad business. Thank you so much, and we respectfully request your support. Thank you.
Any questions? If not, we'll move into those that are opposed to it. Brian Swinney.
While the testifiers are moving up, I'd like to take the opportunity to let everyone know that in my usual fashion, I do try to get all the stakeholders together and talk about this. And we've been working really closely with Mr. Abbott over the last couple of years, and they've been doing really well to work with us. And I think, well, I thought until last week we had a good compromise bill. So.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Sweeney.
Welcome.
I'm the legislative counsel for BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. Even in its amended form, we find the bill, number one, unnecessary, but number two, parts of it are still very difficult to work with. In a practical situation, it's hard to put some of these requirements into effect. I'd like to start by talking about what BNSF does. As was mentioned, we have recently beefed up our policy in this area. In the past, our policy was a general, the employees shall be notified about this. We've improved the policy in December of 2008, I believe, that really spells out a much more detailed notification system. It involves the contract sprayer will notify the roadmaster, that's the person who supervises the people who work on the track. That person will then notify the train master, that's the person who is in charge of the train crews. They are then in charge of distributing that information to the employees who will be working in the affected area. They are to have safety briefings with the employees. The contractor is to take part in those briefings. The MSDS sheets are provided to the employees at those meetings. The contractor is involved. There is special equipment that is available if it's necessary, whether it be disposable overalls or whatever, for employees to use if there's a risk of their clothing becoming soaked if they have to work in the area. They are provided with instruction on how to work in the area. So we do provide this information under our new policy. We have a medical briefing sheet that lists how employees are to work around these substances and the special protective equipment that is available to them. So, again, we believe it's unnecessary from that standpoint. When it comes to notifying all employees who might reasonably be expected to work in the area 48 hours out, that can be very difficult. In a mainline situation that handles 30 or 40 trains a day, knowing 2 days out which members of the pool of employees that have seniority in that region are going to be working in that particular day, we can't really do that. We would have to somehow notify everybody in the pool 48 hours out that it's going to be coming. And then, as was mentioned, you could have people from other railroads whose working in the affected area might consist of being in a locomotive cab and going through it at 50 miles an hour. But these people would all have to be notified as well because they would be working in the affected area. So notifying them would be difficult. Our practice on the subject of alternative duty, if somebody believes that they have a medical condition that would preclude them from working in the area, is basically to try and accommodate them if possible. We don't want to take an employee, put him or her in a situation where we know something bad's going to happen, and then have to go through everything that's involved with a personal injury when that person suffers an injury from an allergic reaction. We're going to try and accommodate that person. Sometimes there isn't another job to give them to do on that particular day, however. For example, their seniority might be limited to that particular area. If they can't work there, then there's no place that they can work. So the alternative for them would be to take a personal leave day. If I went to work and for some reason I was medically unable to do my job that day, I would have to take a sick day or a personal leave day. And so it would be the same situation for that. But we're not in the business of forcing people to go out and work in something that we know is going to make them sick. We will try to accommodate them if we can. In terms of the application to equipment, our concern there was that the language be changed so that if we have a drift situation where it's sprayed here but the wind blows it to another, you know, a few feet and it gets on the equipment, that that be addressed. It looks like the language now covers that. So that portion we have been able to reach agreement on. But again, the provisions, even as amended, we think are unnecessary because we're doing it. Number two, we think that some of the provisions are very complex to work with in a real-world situation, and so we ask that that you reject this bill. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Engelbretson?
I guess I'm the only one asking today, but here I go. Just when you talk about union contracts, does that dictate the work reassignment seniority you talked about? So if you have somebody who you can't assign to, they have to take a personal day leave. I mean, that's kind of part of a union contract. Is that right? Did I understand that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it could be with the train crew in particular. Their seniority allows them to work on a specific track segment. That's their territory. If they can't work on that territory that day, or if they have a yard job position, they would have to go through the bumping process of exercise, you know, using their seniority to try and get a road job to get out of the yard if that's where we're spraying the weeds. It's not that easy to just tell somebody, especially, for example, a train crew, go do something else today. Their job is, the only thing they can do is operate as a member of a train crew, and they have defined territories where they can operate.
Do you have a follow-up first?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could just real quickly. So when you have spray days, you contract that out, I understand. You don't have the train company does not do the spraying. And the second question is it real hard? It must be somewhat hard for that company to plan when you have windy days versus clear spraying days. So is that an issue for you too as well? Or, I mean, does that throw a wrench into it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, I mean, 48 hours out, you know, we all know that the weather forecasters aren't perfect. Yeah, we might wind up with a blustery day that's not anticipated or rain that's not anticipated. It's hard to know exactly 48 hours all the time. So you can have weather problems. You might have a track problem. Something happens with train traffic where all of a sudden they can't give the sprayer the track time that they thought they could. Instead, they've got some priority trains backed up that have to go instead. So that it can alter the actual time and date that the spraying takes place. Even 48 hours, it's hard to know that exactly. In terms of contracting out the spraying, yes, the only spraying that we do, any of our employees do themselves, is if there's like spot weed control. You know, there's a clump of weeds growing by a signal bungalow and somebody takes a bottle of Roundup and squirts those. But we even have rules in place for how that is to be handled and what they're to do with the empty containers and all that type of thing.
Thank you.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question to Senator Erickson Rope. So it looks like the railroad is trying to make some changes. I'm assuming that being the bill is here, you're not completely satisfied with the changes that they're doing. It's just that I personally look in my office and I see all these books of statutes, just law after law after law. I almost like to see people kind of work things out and take care of it themselves, but I'm assuming that you think we need to move forward with legislation. Correct.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coring, that's why we're here today, because there are policies that aren't being followed, and there are incidences happening all across the state. And, yes, I think the fact that we have come a long way in working together on this bill, and Mr. Quayle just reminded me of a ninth item that we had taken off of our bill in an effort to step towards the middle. And BNSF has beefed up their policy, which is a good thing. But policy is only a piece of paper unless it's enacted, or it's enacted equally across all of the tracks. So, yes, I am here today because I do believe we need the legislation to put a little bit of official expectation behind some of this, the business practices.
Senator Skye.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Erickson Ropes, You've talked about this just being policies. The label that's on these chemicals is the law. And if there's restricted access, then there's restricted access. And whether Mr. Swaney's railroad wants to comply with it or not, they have to, because that's what's on the label. And we don't need to put this 48-hour notice in there, because if there's requirements to have restricted access, it's on the label, and that's the law. And I don't know what the railroad is doing, but they should be following what the label requirements already are. And you know, as a farmer, we comply with it. And I don't know what they're doing, but I think that you might want to look at something to do with the railroad, but changing the law with regard to notification of herbicides isn't going to do anything, because we already have those if it's necessary.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, thank you. That's why we did refer to the manufacturer's label instructions so often in this short section. But as this committee has heard many times before and over the years, there are many incidences where the law, according to the manufacturer's label instructions, are not being followed. So I think this gives us one more piece of assurance for the railroad workers across Minnesota that they're going to have some compliance with the manufacturer's labels.
Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Abbott. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, of which the Union Pacific is one member. Mark Wagner, who is the vice president of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association and the president of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad, is back over here, and I'm going to bring him up in just a minute so we can kind of make this as quick as we possibly can.
I got an angle. And
I'm sitting here looking at this right now, looking at the faces around this table, and thinking to myself, every time I get a chance to educate people on railroads, I like to take advantage of it. On the other hand, I know we're at 4 o'clock and you got about three other things on your agenda. If you would indulge me, Mr. Chairman, I want to do about 3 minutes of this 12-minute video. Two things very quickly. We have policy. The railroads have policies and procedures in place, policies and procedures to educate their employees about what they're doing and to notify their employees about what's going to happen. And the reason for that is this is a dangerous business. Safety is a priority on railroads, and you can just imagine why. I mean, this is a lot of steel. These are a lot of equipment. And so we spend a good deal of time educating people. This is a video that every employee who works on the ground is required to see when they go out to when they go out in the field and work.
Essential part of any railroad maintenance program, and an effective way to control that vegetation is through the application of approved herbicides by trained professionals. But why is it important to control weeds in railroad yards and rights of way? And why use herbicides? What are the benefits of using them to get rid of weeds? Are there any precautions we must take in working near them? These are important questions, and in the next few minutes, we'll look at some of the answers. There are a number of good reasons for controlling weeds. The Federal Railroad Administration, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and other regulatory agencies, as well as certain labor agreements, require the railroads to provide a safe working environment, which would include proper vegetation management. Also, railroads have to serve as good neighbors with nearby property owners and the communities they operate in. A railroad can't be a good neighbor if it allows unsightly weeds to grow out of control on its properties. What's more, in some states and counties, controlling weeds is the law. Why? Because depending on the weed species and where they're growing, they can create serious hazards, hazards for you and the public at large. For example, when weeds build up in the berm or ballast area, they lead to serious drainage problems. Natural water drainage paths are obstructed, trapping moisture within the stone on the track bed. Over time, this moisture will deteriorate the tie. During periods of heavy rainfall, standing water can even destabilize the entire roadbed, leading to tie movement and washout. This can lead to potential operating hazards. It could even lead to a derailment. Poor drainage also means that costly, time-consuming tamping and maintenance cycles must be increased. When weeds along the right-of-way die, they lay the foundation for a potentially devastating fire. A single spark can spell disaster for the railroad and nearby property owners. Many states, aware of this hazard, have laws requiring railroads to keep rights-of-way free of weeds. In an environment where trains are constantly on the move, the condition of the roadbed is a critical factor in maintaining a safe working environment. Obviously, no engineer or crew member can operate a train safely when lines of sight are obscured by vegetation. But roadbed vegetation causes another hazard, reduced traction. Weeds and brush between the engine and rail affect both acceleration and braking. Wheels can slip, forcing a loss of control during an emergency. Overgrown track beds make it difficult for track, bridge, and signal inspectors to do their jobs. Broken rails, severed wires, deteriorated ties, and missing bolts can't be seen when they're covered with weeds. Following the law and being a good neighbor is important. But remember that the most important reason for weed control is safety. Safety for the operating crews, safety for the track and yard crews, and safety for the general public. No one wants to work around such noxious plants as poison ivy or stinging nettles, nor should anyone with allergies be needlessly exposed to ragweed. But weeds also create other hazards as well. Excessive vegetation is difficult to walk through. Vines and other tall weeds mask objects that can make you slip, trip, or fall. And in a railroad environment, such a fall can result in serious injury. Switches tangled in weeds are difficult, if not impossible, to throw. Dealing with a rail pile, stockpile, or fueling station infested with weeds is an unpleasant challenge. Vines are a particular nuisance. Some hardy varieties can take over an entire area. And then there's pest problems. Unchecked, uncontrolled vegetation is a natural home for mice, rats, and snakes. It's also a breeding ground for mosquitoes, hornets, bees, ticks, and spiders. No one should have to deal with distracting pests, particularly when trains are moving about. Operating crews, drivers, and pedestrians must be able to see each other clearly at railroad crossings. In fact, many states have laws addressing crossing visibility. Now that you know why it's important to control weeds on railroad properties, let's look at the how part of the problem. What methods are available for controlling vegetation, and what are their advantages and disadvantages? When you come right down to it, there aren't too many choices for controlling unwanted vegetation. For railroad properties, there are two basic options. You can either cut them down or control them with herbicides. Brush cutters, we buy these herbicides, take extensive training to qualify. Residues can remain on switches, rails, and other parts. What can you do to avoid unnecessary exposure? Here are some things to remember when a sprayer is operating near you. Avoid being sprayed directly. If a sprayer is coming toward you, move away from it. If you accidentally come in contact with the spray, don't panic. Just wash the exposed area with soap and water. If you need to work in an area that's just been sprayed, allow the spray to dry before re-entering. How long this takes depends on the relative humidity and temperature. Drying usually takes just a few minutes. Even when the herbicide is dry, it's still a good idea to minimize your exposure. Traces of herbicides can get on your hands during switching or other operations. When that happens, wash your hands. After working in a treated area, don't eat or smoke until your hands are clean. Whenever possible, take preventive measures before crews begin spraying. Inform the applicators of special conditions in the area to be sprayed. Point out sections where spraying should be avoided. Tell them when and where yard and track crews will be working. All these tips are worth keeping in mind, but when in doubt, use common sense. When spraying is being done in your area, don't overreact. Simply try to minimize contact with the chemical. Let it dry after it's been applied. Wash up if any herbicide gets on your skin. These simple precautions are only minor inconveniences when compared to the serious problems caused by uncontrolled vegetation.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your indulgence, but I just wanted to lay out the sort of education that's provided to people before they go into the field and deal with these situations. And understand this happens like once or twice a year. This isn't like something that happens all the time. The other side of the equation is then, well, if you know what's going to happen, do you know when it's going to happen? And that's the question of notice. So there's education, there's notification. I've just given you a sheet here that gives advance notice. This is what goes out in the spring from the Union Pacific Railroad in terms of notifying their employees that certain areas are going to be sprayed. This is a broad notice, as you see. It's during certain periods of the year. And the types of chemicals that are going to be applied and the warnings that are associated therewith. So the notification is given. And then, had I had the occasion to have Tom Fox in here, who is the track projects manager for the Union Pacific, he would have discussed how you go about each day making sure that folks know that this is going to happen. He said the Union Pacific Railroad requires all affected employees to view the video concerning weed spraying operations and then have it discussed each day on the property and at the 8 a.m. call with within each area of operations. Local managers conduct job briefings with all employees affected each day before the weed spraying operations are applied. And if somebody's got a problem with this, they can ask to be taken out of that particular area and are excluded. Now, the other chart that I just gave you was a chart of all the railroads, the 20 different railroads that operate in the state of Minnesota. And the issue is that I think Mr. Ingebrigtsen asked earlier, Senator Ingebrigtsen, can you move some of these employees around? In some instances where you've got a large railroad that's a contract unionized railroad, some of that is difficult, some of it's easy. In other instances, you'll see some of these railroads have 2, 3, and 7 employees involved, and putting this in place complicates what they typically do. Mark Wagner is here, and I've taken enough of your time. Mark Wagner is here with the Twin Cities and Western Railroad, a railroad of about 65 employees that works out in western Minnesota. And I'm just going to let him quickly go over the short line and regional railroad efforts to educate and notify their employees. Then we'll proceed on with this if we may.
Mr. Wagner, would you like to add to it? Welcome to the committee.
Chairman, Senators, thank you for allowing me to be here. As John indicated, we're the Twin City and Western Railroad. We operate from St. Paul to Milbank, South Dakota, through South Central Minnesota. And, yes, we have about 65 to 70 people. And we also contract out our weed spray. Typically what happens is we set a date in about May, June, to preferably May, but sometimes it happens as late as June, depending on the availability of the contractor. But We have a daily notice that goes out to all of our employees what's going on where, so everybody is aware of what's going on. And when the weed spray train is out there, you know, we take the precautions of staying away when it's wet, things like that. And the one question about the variability of the weather, yeah, we're first, I can tell you, yeah, that does affect us because windy days or rainy days, you don't want to be spraying because you get drift issues or you get ineffective issues. So, but we're very careful about letting our employees know what's out there. We, too, use the material data safety sheets that with each kind of chemical we use and make sure that everybody has them. We have them posted at multiple locations so that everybody knows what's going on. And it's in our best interest to be safe. To me, the worst thing that can happen is to have a personal injury of any sort, not because of the financial thing, although it's a big part of it, but more because we want the well-being of our employees. We want them to go home the same way they came in, and that's kind of our whole philosophy. So this kind of legislation that's being proposed, what it will do is it'll cause us to, keep track of things that we don't normally have to keep track of just because it's in our normal course of business. We do also follow the label procedures, and we just think that this is a bit of legislating something that is already happening. So,
could I mention just one last thing, Chairman? I forgot this. I asked the department, and you may if you wish, how big an issue is this with regard to reporting of misuse on railroads? And the department opens about 150 cases a year in terms of misapplication or misuse. That has to be reported. That's label instruction. That's the law. Of that, over the past 5 years, there's been 10 cases reported in 5 years involving railroads. And of that, none of those involve human exposure. This case that was brought earlier is going to be investigated. We were all unaware of that. But that's 10 cases in 5 years. They open about 150 cases a year, and we're talking about none that involve human exposure. So we're wondering if we're not got a solution here that's kind of seeking a problem. I think we do a good job, and we'd like to just continue that way.
Any other questions? Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Senator Erickson Ropes a question about on line 1.8 and elsewhere in the bill. You've got the word pesticide listed. Is there a definition of pesticide?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, thank you for bringing the question up. I think it was the same question you brought up 3 years ago. I did check with Mr. Knopp about whether the definition of pesticide here is too broad because, you know, pesticide, as you know, covers many, many, many different compounds. But he said when it's used in conjunction with commercial or non-commercial applicators, it limits the definition to restricted use pesticides. No. Or Mr. Knopf maybe can explain it better.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson-Ropes, it doesn't completely limit it. A commercial or non-commercial applicator could apply a pesticide that's not restricted use, but these are the applicators that are able to use restricted use. So it's whenever a commercial or non-commercial applicator was applying the pesticide, this provision would apply.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, what is the definition of pesticide?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, definition of pesticide is very, very broad. Means a substance or mixture of substances intended to prevent, destroy, repel, or mitigate a pest, and a substance or mixture of substances intended for use as a plant regulator, defoliant, or desiccant.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, we're kind of back to where we were with this definition of pesticide. That would mean that when the railroad gets ready to disinfect the toilet, which is a bactericide, virucide, that would be a pesticide, you'd have to give the workers 48 hours notice. And if they're going to use a rodenticide to kill rats under the tiles or railroad ties they've got there or some building or some storage facility, a rodenticide would be a pesticide also. Or if you're going to use an insecticide for mosquito control or all these would be pesticides, which I think would fall under this, the way this is structured here, I think that would be be covered. And then you've got the issue that one of the railroad men just brought up of spot spraying with Roundup or 2,4-D. He didn't mention 2,4-D, but spot spraying with a small sprayer just to kill a few mist weeds here and there. That may trigger a 48-hour requirement. Am I right or wrong on that, Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, only if it's been applied by, if you hired a commercial applicator to apply, I don't know that you would hire a commercial applicator to do that, or a non-commercial applicator that actually, they're the people who actually work, would be working for the railroad company that would be certified to apply restricted use pesticides. So unless you were hiring somebody to apply restricted use pesticides to do those things, it would not apply.
Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, on line 1.7, it says a railroad company using commercial or non-commercial applicators to apply pesticides. You're assuming that those words mean a restricted-use pesticide.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, those terms are defined in the pesticide law that you're amending here to be those people who are certified to apply restricted-use pesticides.
Well, then when we look at this list of pesticides that we got from the Union Pacific Railroad, I don't know off the top of my head on how many of them are restricted use, but I would guess that probably no more than half of them are.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, that was one of the reasons. There was a thought about using just, say, whenever they apply a restricted use pesticide, but since some of them are not restricted use, it was thought that it would be better that whenever you hire somebody who can apply restricted use, that whatever pesticide they apply, that this law apply to that. So it would apply to those non-restricted use pesticides as long as they're being applied by a commercial or non-commercial applicator.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, in other words, if a railroad employee goes out there with a hand spray to spray 2,4-D on spot spray weeds out there, that he doesn't fall under this law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, if the person was a railroad employee and was licensed as a non-commercial applicator, it would, but otherwise, no.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up after the presentation from the railroad folks. It seems that they're primary argument about not supporting the bill has to do with the fact that they're already doing this. And I would just focus the committee's attention on the first set of testifiers and the packet of information that you've gotten. And we hear these kinds of things every year from people all across the state in different situations that the manufacturer's instructions are not being followed. The internal policies of businesses are not being followed, and people want some reassurance in the state of Minnesota that they are going to be have an opportunity to get notified when these pesticides are being used in their workplace. So I think to say that they're already doing it as a reason to not support the bill, I would say the reason they already have these policies actually is a reason to support the bill, because if they're doing it, what is the problem with having it written into law?
Senator Coring. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question to Mr. Knopf. If it is like Senator Erickson Ropes is saying, that they're not following the directions on the container, what is the penalty for that?
Mr. Knopf. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Coring, I mean, they have to follow the law and the label, as Senator Skoy stated earlier. The label is the law, right. And in fact, our Department of Agriculture can enforce any misuse under the label, even though it's a federal law. It's actually been codified in the statute, so they can enforce that. So the label is the law, and the penalties can be. I mean, there are a number of penalties that the department has fairly broad enforcement authority. On this, including civil and administrative penalties, and they can, you know, take actions to make them stop what they're doing, that sort of thing.
And so then, Mr. Chairman, so then Mr. Knopf, then taking it the next step further, let's say hypothetically this legislation passed, what's any different than what's available right now for enforcement?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Coyne, what they would be able to enforce this specific law. where if this specific law were violated, this specific whatever what you have in front of you was violated, that would also be under the enforcement authority of the Commissioner of Agriculture, where this is stronger than current the current label, that would be that could be enforced under the pesticide law.
Any further discussion? Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question from I guess either either the employees or the railroad company. How many people are we talking about that have been injured or been sick? Maybe that was part of the testimony. Have we had any recent cases, and if so, how many pertaining to this substance?
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, we have varying numbers, and I don't have the hard statistical answer to your question. I think the key here that we'd like respectfully to submit to the committee today is that whatever is not happening in the breakdown of notification of crews before the sprayers are coming through, they're private contractors, we don't know they're showing up on the property. We have people who are being exposed against MSD requirements, MSDS requirements. And so I cannot answer your question specifically, but I once would like to, again, advocate for passage of this bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbrechtson, I guess my position on the numbers is it doesn't really matter to me what the numbers are. We have passed bills in the legislature relating to one person's bad experience, for example, with a swimming pool, because we don't want this to happen to other people. So whether we're talking about one person or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, I think it's important for employee health.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I don't know who this question would be directed to either, but in the video, I couldn't help but notice that there was this big truck that was running down alongside the tracks with the booms out and spraying. And I also couldn't help but notice that the driver, was sitting in there with no respiratory equipment on, and I'm assuming that driver probably is in that truck for extended periods of time, changing wind conditions. I guess my question would be, is there a policy for that driver, and would that driver have been out of compliance? Because it's just not all coming together for me here. If the applicator isn't using special equipment, respirators, clothing, and all of that, what is the extent of the actual concern here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gibbs, I'll take a stab at that. Just to say that I'm not here bringing a bill on behalf of the commercial or non-commercial applicators.
Any further discussion? Senator Ropes, I got a suggestion for you.
Yes, sir.
Maybe we ought to move your bill, roll it into a big omnibus bill that we're going to put together, because I don't know where that's what the House is going to do. And then we have a little more time to sort through this, because we've got two bills, and I'm going to be out of here by 5 o'clock at the latest.
Mr. Chairman, is that contingent on whether it passes or not? Or you're not just going to lay it over, are you?
I just suggested. Senator can do exactly what she wants to do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to lay it over for inclusion in a possible bill.
No, I don't agree with that.
Well, you have a right.
Mr. Chairman, I think this committee needs to vote either yes or no. Rather than laying it over, is then we haven't even voted on it.
Well, I think the rules are, and I might be corrected, if she wants to do it. I don't know if you can debate that, or can we, Mr. Knopf? You probably know more than I know about it.
Mr. Chairman, in committee, you can debate these different motions, whereas on the floor, there are certain motions that are non-debatable, but in committee, you can pretty much debate anything.
Okay.
It's a nice day out. Does anybody want to debate?
Can't argue that one.
Well, right
but
now.
But Mr. Chairman, to Senator Coring's point, You know, even if Senator Ropes puts the bill on the table, we still vote on yes or no whether or not it goes into the omnibus bill.
We do. Mr. Chairman, we would vote specifically on this, or what if, let's just say hypothetically it was rolled into the omnibus bill, and I like everything else that's in the omnibus bill, and I say, well, I don't really like this, well, but then I have to vote for this anyway. Why wouldn't we just vote on this, whether or not this is worthy or not to pass?
I believe, Mr. Chair, couldn't you make a motion or an amend? You could amend it out when we put the bill together.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of a convoluted way to do things.
A motion on the table by Senator Ropes, as we move, if this passes, which goes into the ominous, for possible inclusion in an ominous bill. Now, the vote we take now is whether you want that to happen or not. Is that right? I want to be sure I get it right.
I do every time.
So on, Senator, you have a question, Senator Corey?
No. I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen.
You know, maybe I could get a clarification on some of these rules from Council, because in some of our committees we lay stuff on the table for possible inclusion. We don't even vote on it.
Well, that's
discretion of the chair.
I know. Is that what it is? Discretion of the chair. I mean, I would like know what the rule is here.
Senator Vice Chair, what's the rule?
Mr. Chair, just to that point, and Senator Coring, I believe we spent most of the morning laying over bills for possible inclusion in our morning committee
without ever voting.
Without voting.
And Mr. Chairman. And Senator Erickson Ropes is right, but I don't like that because I'm just – then all I am is window dressing. I'm sitting here and I'm getting paid, and I'm not making a decision on anything. The chair is making a decision what goes in a bill, and then they roll it out, and all I have to do is either vote yes or no on the whole thing. I'd like to have a little bit of choice on this, and this. An input, because I paid my, like Dick Day says, I paid my $100 to come here. I think the 75,000 people that I represent want to have their voice heard here too. So I just think that we should either vote yes or no, and if it passes, fine, then put it in.
Senator Hand, give us some advice.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think, and Senator Coring, if you want to vote, I think if you made a motion to pass the bill, we'd have to vote on it.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, but I think in the Senate, as a courtesy, when Senator Erickson Ropes is on the committee, I just don't know that it's my place to move her bill. It's her bill to move. Am I right? I can do that, but I just as common courtesy, I don't want to be moving her bill when she's on the committee.
On the Ropes Amendment. All those
and what's the amendment?
Senator Ropes?
Motion. I'll give it a try. I'll lay it over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Do you understand the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Nope, opposed?
Aye.
No.
Aye.
I suppose I could use the excuse I can't hear, but.
There we go. We were wondering if it was true or not.
Mr. Chairman, I think those people downtown at the parade heard it.
Well, it didn't pass, so now we're right back to where we are.
Bill's on the table.
Next bill. Next bill.
Your bill.
Is the bill?
No, I'm. The motion was to include, move it, include it in here, and that got defeated. Mm-hmm. So what? I need to know what happens now.
Mr. Chairman, you probably just want to lay it over for further study or whatever. But you can do that.
I can do that?
Yeah.
Then I'm going to do that because I think we need to work this out. I really do. I think there's common ground between both places.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it would be helpful, I'd move that we lay this bill on the table for further study.
Okay.
Whatever the Senate file number is.
On a SCOI amendment.
691.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
I don't spend
Boy, now this. You know these nursery schools. You got to do something about those. Yeah. Isn't that what you got now, nurseries?
I think he's going there.
See now, on the table for further study. When I study it, we'll take it out.
That's also the prerogative of the chair.
We do want to
spill. Ominous.
Senator Vickerman, Senate File 1507.
Members, this is going to be an easy one. Senate File 1507. What it does, British Island, to establish a Feeding Minnesota Task Force. Food shelves are running out of food. Trying to be sure we got enough food for food shelves. We've created a task force. We'll take a look and see. Take and see what we can do with food that is not wasted, but food that's left over. There's lots of apples, there's lots of vegetables that could move the food shelf. We could figure out a way to do that. So, Mr. Searles, you're the one that brought this forward. I was questioning it, and people have been ringing off the hook about this, so this is one of them good deals. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Searle, welcome to the committee.
For the record, I'm Newell Searle, Vice President, Second Harvest Heartland, and we are one of the six Feeding America regional food banks that serves the state of Minnesota, and we act collaboratively to serve the whole state.
Mr. Searle, can I interrupt for a minute? I have a whole bunch of people out here. That I want to stand them to stand up and recognize all the work that you've done, if you would. Senator DeKramer, if that would be proper. Stand up. And we don't usually do that, but I'm going to do as long as I'm doing everything else.
Senator Vickerman, it's your committee. You can do what you like. We wish to recognize.
Thank you very much. No, Mr. Chair.
It's another thing we can do in committee is clap.
And members, it's former Senator Gary DeKramer joining us here. Mr. Searle.
Thank you. Thank you. And I will say that the two students who are here and two others who are not here did heavy lifting on this proposal, and we collaborated over the last fall. It is not a surprise that the present economic crisis has cost tens of thousands of Minnesotans their jobs, their savings, and many of them their homes. And the state's 300 food shelves and their six food banks are seeing large increases in numbers of people who need emergency food, which naturally puts pressure on us to find more of it. I would just hold up, just as an example of how things are, the Fairfax Standard, the headline, Renville County Food Shelf, Busier Than Ever. And they report that the number of people they served in 2008 was 14% higher than the ones they served in 2007, and that in 2009 they're busier at this time of the year than they were last year at this time of the year. And last year's they served 2,500 families and over 9,000 individuals. And this story is repeating itself throughout the state of Minnesota, as I'm sure comes as no surprise to you. Second Harvest Heartland has just completed a rather comprehensive study using public data on how much need exists in Minnesota in terms of emergency food. And these are based, unfortunately, on 2007 numbers, so if anything, they're conservative. And we find that low-income persons below about 185% of poverty in aggregate miss about 12% of the meals that they need, assuming people eat three times a day, 365 days a year, which is what's necessary to sustain your health. We receive lots of donations from corporations, the USDA commodities, local food drives. These are all significant. But as we look around for that to cover the missing meals, we also notice that there's a lot of potential for after-harvest donations of crops, apples, carrots,
I checked on the pumpkins, by the way, Senator. Those orange ones are only decorative. You can't eat those. People have tried. But there's plenty. There are root crops. There are vegetable crops. There are cold crops, broccoli, kale, and others that are not harvested. But at the end of the season, they are allowed to either, if it's apples, fall to the ground or get plowed under. This is hard work on the part of the farmers who raise those crops. I've yet to meet a farmer, and I grew up on a farm, I've yet to meet a farmer who likes to plow under a crop. And this is food that can be donated. There are barriers to donation. And so this task force is a way to begin to look at what does Minnesota have to offer in the way of donated produce, fruit, and animals that are raised under contract but don't meet specification. They're underweight, for example, in the case of hogs and poultry. So they're not taken by the processor. Then the farmer has an animal that he's invested in, and he has no particular market for that animal. And I know producers who have, because they had the financial means to donate a hog or two from time to time. But there is food out there to be had, to be used, to sustain the health and well-being of people, particularly during a tough time. And this task force would begin the process of looking at, systematically looking at what does Minnesota's farmers have to offer in the way of after-harvest products. I hate to use the word surplus. It has connotations that are not always positive. But it's after harvest. It's after they're done selling everything they can sell. There's still apples on the tree, carrots in the ground, hogs in the barn. And what are the barriers to making a donation where they could possibly get a tax deduction? What are the barriers to food banks to accept that that possible donation? That would be the work of this task force. And I would urge your support for Senate File 1507.
And Mr. Searle, I think this sounds like a great idea. I do have a couple of thoughts on this. And the first one is, if there was some way to establish a baseline value, because the farmers would be, depending on their income, would be able to deduct. And that would be something that would be important if we could set a mechanism in place for establishing the baseline value of the crop so they knew what kind of dollar amount would be deductible. And I think it sounds like a very interesting proposal, and I wish your task force good luck if you get passed into law. Questions, members? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think everybody in the committee knows what I think about the venison donation program. Has that been anything at all you've looked into, or where's that at with you? And I know there's the actual, not production, I would say, but the poundage went from 78,000 pounds down to 20,000 pounds because of the lead issue that we imposed here two years ago. Is that?
Mr. Searle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ingebrigtsen, we really are awaiting I won't say instructions, but the next move by the Department of Agriculture and the Department of DNR. It's really not within our power to make any change in that until either the regulatory agencies or the legislature does so. So there's really nothing new to report on that since the issue was heard in Senator Chaudhry's committee, at least from our end.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with your dealings with that particular program is as it had been before the law, was it a pretty good program? Was it pretty successful, would you say?
Mr. Searle.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Ingebrigtsen, was the venison program before the law a good program? There really wasn't a lot of donation, certainly not in our particular food bank. I think the food bank in Grand Rapids got some and the food bank in Rochester got some, but it was not a significant portion of the total volume of food that we distributed. So I really don't have a baseline pre-law, post-law from which to operate.
Any other questions, members? Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Chairman, I met with Senator Moe the other day in the Hmong community. They have a farmer's market, and when it gets to the end, they don't know what to do with what they don't sell. So she's interested in also being part of this, where they couldn't just take that food. Mm-hmm. I'd like to sit here before you and say it's going to get better out there, but it's not going to for a while. and there are going to be more people. I know my hometown. 500 people usually are there. 1,500 are showing up. Now, that many more are coming. And, you know, this food just goes to waste. If I could figure out a way to get a refrigerator, we could get beef and milk and all that. But you can't because we don't have the coolers to take care of it. So we're going to start slow. I hope this moves and moves. And if it does pass here, it'll go to, I think, state and local government operation because of the task force. Then we'll go from here. But I invite anybody else who would like to add to this. We've got the youth corps trying to figure out a job for them.
Mr. Chair, we
Boy Scouts, if they could help pick up some of the volunteer to help pick up some of this food.
Senator Vickerman, maybe you or Mr. Searle, we did have a question from staff about who the Youth Conservation Corps is. Is there some, who would we use to define that? That's not their name. Mr. Searle?
I'm not exactly sure who is, but the Youth Conservation Corps, we put that in part to, there may be youth programs, sentencing to serve is another one where they do public service work. And if it's not exactly the YCC organizations of programs of that kind where gleaning and harvesting is an appropriate activity for youth.
Mr. Knopf, do you have some advice for a little language that might clarify?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the way it's written here, it's capitalized as Youth Conservation Corps as if it's the name of an entity. And what Mr. Searle has been mentioning is kind of more of a generic, including somebody that representing youth work organizations or something to that effect. And so it might be best to do it in a more generic form and delete Youth Conservation Corps and insert youth. I would just say youth core organizations.
Senator Vickerman moves on page 2, line 3, changing the Youth Conservation Corps to small y youth
core
organizations. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator, anybody else that would like to testify on Senate File 1507? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves.
Mr. Chair, could I just make one suggestion?
Senator Ingram.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was part of the process of, you mentioned sentence to serve. We actually had our prisoners grow a garden about an acre and a half, and we donated to the food shelf. Have you looked into that any further? Of talking with sheriffs and maybe getting something like that rolling. It's a wonderful opportunity for minimum security folks to get out, and they really enjoy it, and they get something productive, and the public really likes it.
Mr. Searle.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, I was not aware of that. It sounds like an excellent idea, and it certainly would be good both for the young people. We use sentencing to serve at Maplewood. They do cleanup work around our grounds and in our buildings, and we use them in that way, but we're not exactly in a place to have a garden there. But right. I think, and especially in greater Minnesota as well, where there's opportunity for that, that's certainly something that we will suggest to our agencies.
Well, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that's part of the reason for putting this task force together is
sure.
to explore all these ideas that we have out and about and see what we can come up with for good ideas.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, I would offer up my expertise, but my help in contacting sheriffs with this idea, and maybe we could move forward with something like that. There's always somebody out there that's got some ground where the prisoners can grow stuff, and you'd be surprised what a good program really is.
Very good. Senator Vickerman moves Senate File number 1507 be recommended to pass and referred to state and local
government operations.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Vickerman. And Senator Vickerman, you have Senate File 566. Is Mr. Bozicki going to join you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is called a waste pesticide bill for the department bill that we are working together on. Expert, hopefully, will help me with the questions. So if you would state your name for the record, and then we'll start.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bozicki. If you could briefly walk us through the bill and tell us what you're doing here.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Greg Bozicki. I'm the Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management. This is a department bill and addresses actually two issues, some minor changes to the waste pesticide collection program and some changes to the fertilizer law. I can walk through very quickly as to what those changes are. In on the first page on lines 1.11 and 1.12, we make a minor change, and that is actually putting the law back to the way it was prior to last year's amendments. This simply gives the commissioner the ability to limit the type and quantity of waste pesticides accepted at the collection, and the possibility to assess end users for portions of the cost. One of the experiences that we had last year as we were beginning our revitalized program is that we had one facility bring in 20,000 pounds of pesticide that was some of it was still shrink-wrapped, and it was brand-new pesticide, but because of some kind of purchase agreement, they wanted to dispose of it, and there was no way for us to even recoup some of the costs or turn them away. At one point, our staff actually thought that the material had come across the border from North Dakota, and it wasn't even Minnesota pesticide. That turned out not to be the case. The authority that we have, that we used to have, we've actually never used. But this was a type of situation that we would get very concerned about if someone were to use the waste pesticide program as just a vehicle to dump a tremendous amount of pesticides that might be better used or better disposed of in a number of fashion, or at least not to bankrupt the account. So that is a change that we're requesting just in that unusual instance. As I said, we never use that authority, but we would like to have it just in case. On the second page, on lines 2.6, there is a technical change, or 2.8. We're asking for the ability to accept either the EPA registration number or the description of the material. It makes it easier for record keeping. Mr. Chair, the fertilizer provisions begin on line 2.11, and perhaps rather than walking through the language, I can describe what it is and answer any questions. I think that might be simpler.
Very good.
About 20 years ago when we passed the Groundwater Protection Act, the industry approached us with the idea that we should collect our fertilizer fees higher up in the distribution chain than we were. At the time, we were collecting them from the last seller of fertilizer to the retailer, or to the grower, excuse me, from the retailer to the grower. That change was put into law, and that has worked for a number of years. But more recently, staff have indicated that there's more and more confusion or people explaining that somebody else has paid the fees, and we may not be collecting all the fees that are due because it gets complicated in the distribution system to actually ferret that out. So what we're proposing here is to go back to the way we used to collect the fees from the retailer to the grower. This is the way all the other states do it, and this is the way we used to do it. I think South Dakota is actually the exception. But that's basically the intent. We think it would be much clearer because it would be very clear who is selling to the growers. And it's basically that simple. This would not affect the folks who register pesticides and sell specialty products like what you'd buy in the garden stores, the bag products, that would still be the registration person, like Scott's, would still be responsible. So we wouldn't get down to that deal. But for agriculture, this would be a far simpler way to collect it. And then the only other change that I would point out to the committee is that we are asking for the penalty for a late payment. That hasn't been changed in years, and we're asking to increase that from $25 to $50 to encourage timely reporting. Mr. Chair, if there's any questions, that's on line 3.6. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. We had to move a lot of the language around, but this is what we're up to here.
And Mr. Buzicki, so with regard to the fertilizer, where you're collecting that, so you were having trouble ascertaining when the fertilizer was moving from a distributor to the co-op, and now you're going to try to collect it when the co-op sells to the farmer, as opposed when the distributor was, you know, selling to the local co-op, or what's? I'm not exactly sure I get the problem there.
Mr. Chair, the way the current statute reads and is implemented is the first sale into the state is where we collect the fee. So if potash coming from Saskatchewan was being sold to retailers, we would collect that fee. What we've encountered is a number of retailers and wholesalers and distributors, as it moves through, are believing, correctly or incorrectly, that someone else has paid for these for that material. So when they fill out, they all have to fill out a form to us to report how much fertilizer they sold, and on that form they would indicate how much fee is due. We're seeing more and more of those forms coming to us saying, well, somebody else has paid this fee, so I don't have to pay it. But when you go back and try to determine how many tons have actually been paid by somebody further up the chain, it gets very complicated, and it becomes very difficult for us to ascertain whether that, in fact, has happened. So we have talked with the fertilizer industry, and they have to pay the fees one way or another, and we believe this is a level playing field issue, and they don't have any concerns about putting it down to the retailer level. Okay. It will be very clear that if it's the last seller selling to an end user, who those people are, so there should be no confusion about who pays the fees now.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Buzicki, this isn't a big thing, but I was just wondering on this this fee penalty, how many people are filing late currently?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, we are getting, I believe, 5 to 10% late payment out of about 800. So 40 to 80, I believe is what staff told me.
Other questions, members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify in support of or in opposition to Senate File 566? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I work with the Solid Waste Administrators Association as well. Over the past several years, we've been working with Department of Agriculture on the waste pesticide collection programs that have been going on in the state. And I'll be very brief in my testimony. I'm referring to a very small portion of the bill. It's lines 1.11 through 1.13. And we're very satisfied to the point where we have gotten our negotiations with Department of Ag. There was a waste pesticide task force that was held over last summer. And I understand the need that Ag is wanting to clarify what they're able to take away and what they might want to charge for. Certainly the 20,000 pounds is something that is not a normal thing that counties or Department of Ag sees. But I do want to let you know that I've been working with Senator Vickerman and the Department of Ag to come up with some language, some comfort language that would make this read that if the county who has a contract with Department of Ag is collecting loads of waste pesticides, that Department of Ag couldn't say that they would be able to limit the type and quantity of waste pesticide that comes in and turn back things that the county has already collected. So, and I know that's not the intent of this language, and I'm confident that we'll be able to work something out with Department of Ag to resolve this and give this the comfort language that counties are looking for as we cooperate with them and participate in these collections.
Ms. Garlitz, do counties have the ability to, when you're collecting this household waste pesticide, to turn away collection, somebody from collection? I think Senator or Representative Saylor was talking to me about this, and I think she thought that you did.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that counties probably are able to do that. There's nothing that says that we can't, but I don't know of a county that would turn it away unless it was such a huge amount that we couldn't store it or didn't have the facilities or the ability to hold it. The main thing that we're all looking to do as well is to try to get this off of the property owner's hands so that they're not dumping it, and that a more expensive cleanup is something that has to take place in the future. So I haven't heard stories about people turning it away. Most of the time, if there's something that needs to be taken, you can organize with the county or Department of Ag or let people know of a collection event that's going to be happening in the summer.
Yes, Ms. Garlitz, I don't think anybody has turned it away, but I'm just trying to make the point that we're just going to put the department on the same playing field, that if there did happen to be a unique circumstance, they would have the ability. And hopefully you guys are able to work out whatever language works for everybody here. Other questions, members?
Chair, and I would move that Senate File 566 be recommended to passing it. Refer to finance because it's finance.
Senator Vickerman moves Senate File number 566, no amendments, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's one.
Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Senator Scogin, House File 598.
Damn, this one's going down. Yep. Let's vote on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have House File 598, and I believe, Mr. Knopf, we have the House File because they passed it off the floor over there. Is that right? And we're just trying to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, that's right. In fact, it even shows it in the, if you look at the title, above the title of the bill, it shows that it passed the House as amended and transmitted to the Senate, including the committee and four amendments, the last notation on there.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogin, just because it passed the House, it doesn't mean much.
I understand that, Senator Murphy. Just trying to speed this along.
Okay.
The chairman would like us out of here by 5.
Senator Scogin.
Well, then move the bill.
Tell us what you've got going on with your House counterpart, Eakin and McNamara.
After a long winter, yesterday gave us hope. Soon we'll be planting plants. We want them to be good. Consumers are having some concerns about the plants that are being offered because some of them aren't as hardy as they should be. And here to tell you all about it is someone from the department.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Geir Friso. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division. You'll notice my name is Norwegian, so please excuse my lack of green today. This really is, as Senator Scogin pointed out, kind of a consumer protection bill, and it's in response to growing complaints that we've been having about dormant stock that's coming to Minnesota way too early in the season, mainly to box stores, and consumers are buying this material, and it just simply doesn't survive. So we've made a number of technical amendments in the definition sections. We also made just a slight correction to what that nursery dealers are also may be growers, and so we simply added that to that definition. We've clarified the annual certificate renewal date to be the postmark, just to because there's always some uncertainty as to when somebody mailed their renewal. And all these technical changes have been reviewed with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, as well as our Nursery Advisory Committee, and they are supportive of these technical changes.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Friesel, right?
Friesel, yes, sir.
The only question I have is, what is...
There's a definition about three lines down, Senator Murphy.
There you go. That's the one. 1.13.
Mr. Friesel, what's etiolated growth, or whatever it is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, is etiolated, and that simply means an extension of a new stem that's lacking sunlight, so there's not you're not getting chlorophyll synthesis. So it is a technical botanical term.
Under the straw bale.
Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair.
I understand that definition, Senator Scogin. So this sounds like a good bill, and Representative McNamara is, his family owns a nursery, and so I imagine that if he's comfortable, I am.
And Senator Scogin, when Mr. Swanson from Park Rapids comes and visits me next year for the Nursery Stock Growers Day, he's going to be happy with what we did today?
He certainly will, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Senator Scogin, do you have a motion? Where are we going?
Do you want it on the floor or in an omnibus bill?
Floor.
I've been told it can go to the floor.
Goes to floor.
Then, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 598 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Senator Scogin moves House File number 598 be recommended to pass and go to the floor. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator
Mr.
Scogin.
Thank you.
Committee's work is done for the day. Where's your...
Woohoo!